this big pile of dregs. I'm dragged into the room again. And the problem is that the dregs are just so tasty to slurp. And I want to share them with you. Please excuse me. We have several dreg threads running through this session. We started hearing the story of the Buddha's birth, since this is Buddha's birthday session. And we'll celebrate Buddha's birthday tomorrow. So this is the Mahayana Lalita Vistara Sutra, the play of Buddha and Buddha's life in all the grand splendor of the great vehicle sutras. And yesterday's section on the 108 luminous Dharma gates, this was the Bodhisattva who would soon become the Buddha, be born as the Buddha, the Bodhisattva residing in Tushita heaven. Just before leaving that heaven realm, he taught these 108 luminous Dharma gates, which I mentioned yesterday, is the last Shobogenzo fascicle of Dogen. He quotes this entire chapter from this sutra, and so you can read that if you'd like in Kanzen Tanahashi's translation, the 96th final chapter. It's just pulled right out of the sutra here. And now we're into the next chapter. He's still the Bodhisattva. He's still in Tushita heaven. And now he's the Buddha on earth recounting this sutra to the assembly about these events before his birth. O monks, after the Bodhisattva had instructed the great assembly of gods, the devas, with this discourse on Dharma, these 108 gates of practice, after he'd helped them understand clearly, had encouraged them, delighted them, and strengthened their patience, he spoke again, "Friends, I shall now go into the land of Jambudvipa, the rose apple island land that we call planet Earth." There may be some debate whether Jambudvipa means the Indian subcontinent or the entire planet, because the Indian cosmology was pretty wacky. They didn't have globes and world maps at that time. They were kind of confused how things looked. "I'm going to leave Tushita heaven now and go to Jambudvipa. Formerly, when I engaged in the practice of a bodhisattva, I invited beings to join me in four ways." These are the four methods of gathering beings or embracing and sustaining beings. The way to setsu the beings, like in Sesshin. These four ways are giving, kind speech, helpfulness or beneficial action, and consistency between words and deeds, or identity action. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Have you heard that outside the sutra? Do you know where these four appear? They're actually what Dogen calls the Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance, which is another Shobogenzo fascicle. Beautiful teaching on giving, kind speech, beneficial action and identity action. But it's a, and related to the precepts, they're very much like that, and like the paramitas, but it's particularly this list of four. The more you look into these Mahayana sutras, the more you see that Dogen is constantly pulling stuff out of the sutras. So I engaged in these bodhisattva practices. So how unfitting and ungrateful on my part if now I did not become a perfect, completely enlightened Buddha. You know, it would be ungrateful to these beings that I've helped and gathered to practice Dharma. If I don't become a Buddha, it's kind of like it's neglecting them. Bodhicitta is vowing to become a Buddha. It would be ungrateful if I didn't. Kind of unusual to hear like that. At this, the devas of Tushita heaven wept, because they're going to lose their companion and teacher up there. He's going to descend to Jambudvipa. Embracing the feet of the Bodhisattva, they implored him, "Noble being, if you leave, this Tushita realm will lose all its glory." In response, the Bodhisattva, he's talking about himself, replied, "The Bodhisattva Maitreya will teach you the Dharma." The future Buddha, Maitreya. He placed the diadem, the crown, from his own head upon the head of the Bodhisattva Maitreya and said, "Noble being, after me you will become the perfect and completely enlightened Buddha." So this is a heavenly Dharma transmission or something. And that's the story that we have now, is that Maitreya Buddha is still residing in Tushita heaven, waiting to be born in Jambudvipa in the next era. It might be a while. They live for a long, long time in Tushita heaven. But he's kind of like passing on Maitreya will teach you devas and bodhisattvas in Tushita heaven now that I'm leaving. In this manner, monks, did the bodhisattva consecrate the Bodhisattva Maitreya in Tushita heaven. He then addressed himself to that great assembly of gods. "Companions, in what form shall I enter into the womb of a mother?" He's kind of like consulting with his companions. "How do you think we should do this? This birth thing now?" I mean, in this realm of where mind creates the world, we can play. This is the Sutra of the Buddha's play. So they kind of like have this sort of debate going. Some of them said, "How about a human form?" Others said, "In the form of Chakra, the great god." Others said, "In the form of Brahma." Still others said, "In the form of a great king." Others said, "In the form of a guardian Dharma protector." Others said, "In the form of Rahu." As a Gandharva, a Kimnara, a Mahauraga, a Mahashvara. They had a lot of opinions on how he should enter the womb. In the form of Chandra, the moon, or Surya, the sun. In the form of a Garuda. Then this particular deva of the Brahma realm, who was a rishi in a previous life, a seer, who in this birth had attained enlightened, irreversible state. He says, "Since all this information is found in the Brahman books, in the Vedas and commentaries, and we know, actually, how you should enter. It's in the books, okay?" I used to, you know, study these Brahman books. "We know the Bodhisattva must enter the womb of his mother in the magnificent form of a great elephant with six tusks covered with golden netting, with body beautiful and gracious. A Brahmin who knows the meaning of the Vedas and commentaries will predict that one entering the womb in this form will be endowed with the 32 signs of a great being. So it seems like the Bodhisattva decided to go with what's written in the Vedas. Okay, we'll do the elephant thing. We'll do the elephant womb entry. I mean, he's going to be born as a human, but it's going to start like this. And has anyone been to Green Dragon Temple on Buddha's birthday? Seen this? They enact this, the pageant of Buddha's birth and pre-birth, and maybe the highlight is this elephant. Six-tusked white elephant, life-size, you know, elephant size. It takes four people to maneuver this elephant. One is each leg, and one is the trunk, I think. Maybe it's five people. And how this elephant gets into the womb of Buddha's mother is not so clear. So the Bodhisattva still residing in Tushita heaven then examined like the time and place of his birth and manifested in the pure abode of King Suddhodana, who would be his father, all these signs of a Buddha's birth coming, like the ground was all cleared, all the garbage was swept up miraculously, all these birds from the Himalayas came and started singing, and flowers started raining in that land of Kapilavastu and Lumbini. And then Maya Devi, so Buddha's mother's named Maya Devi, illusion queen, we could say. Devi is like a celestial being or a queen, and Maya means illusion. So Buddha's mother is actually, her name is illusion. Maya Devi, after bathing and rubbing her body with aloes, covered her arms with bracelets and dressed herself in the finest and most beautiful of festival garments, filled with contentment, joy, and happiness, surrounded and preceded by 10,000 attendants, she approached King Suddhodana, who was seated at ease in the middle of the concert hall. Sitting herself down at his right on the seat of honor, which was draped with jeweled netting, she spoke to the king with a smile on her lips, her brow unwrinkled. "Pray, heed, great Lord, protector of the earth, grant me the favor I ask of you today. Learn the intention which brings joy to my heart and rejoice with me. I wish to undertake, my husband and king, I wish to undertake a practice of strict moral conduct and fasting. For the love of all beings, I will adhere to all forms of practice. Keeping my thoughts always pure, I will avoid harm to all beings. As I love myself, so will I love others." And so she wishes to go into retreat, like Sasheen. Having put aside the distracted mind, I will, you know, set aside all these everyday activities and just concentrate the mind and practice goodness. She has this urge to do a sasheen, go into some kind of retreat. And of course he says, "Great, that sounds wonderful, please go ahead." So he describes what, you know, this great practice of, kind of bodhisattva practice that she's doing. She doesn't know yet about the the bodhisattvas coming to her womb any minute, but that she feels maybe the rumblings in Tushita heaven of something going to happen, and she just wants to purify her mind. O monks, at the time of the descent of the bodhisattvas, several hundreds of thousands of bodhisattvas who dwelt in Tushita and had but one birth remaining came to the east to honor him. For those who didn't hear yesterday, this is part of the story, is that there's hundreds of thousands of bodhisattvas in addition to Maitreya in Tushita heaven, and that's where all the bodhisattvas go when it's their last birth before becoming a Buddha. So there's all these bodhisattvas kind of waiting in line to become Buddhas, each one in their own kind of world system and kalpa. So they may be going to be waiting for a long time. Even Maitreyas wait a long time. There's hundreds of thousands ready to be born as Buddhas, but they have a great time up in Tushita heaven, just constantly listening to Dharma. So then what happened was the departing bodhisattva projected from his body a light surpassing divine light, a light so great that 3,000 great thousands of worlds were completely filled with light. Abundant light, light which had never before been seen, extended everywhere. Neither the sun nor moon, for all their strength and power, has the magnitude or strength, the color or glory to illuminate what is wrapped in the darkness of delusion, nor can they illuminate the places plunged in obscurity. Beings in such places can never even see their own outstretched arms. It's so dark, they can't even see that far. But now a great and majestic light enveloped them so that they saw each other perfectly and recognized each other and said, "So, other beings have been born here too." They thought they were just alone in the darkness. And then there's the bodhisattva's light pervading all these realms. They see each other in this whole wide world. And all the worlds were shaken in these various ways that happens when the Buddha's about to do something. This chapter is called The Descent into the Womb. Monks, the cold weather had passed, the spring had arrived. Springtime, the most beautiful of all the seasons, when the new leaves decorate the trees and the earth is covered with flowers. Soft green grass carpeted the earth. The air was neither too cold nor too hot. And neither fog nor dust tainted the breeze. It was the month of Vaishakha, when the constellation Vishakha returns. So though this is just the descent into the womb, it happened in Vaishakha, and you might notice that sometimes in other traditions, Buddha's birthday is called Vaisak. It's the month of spring. The Bodhisattva, Lord of the three worlds revealed by all the world, saw that the right time had arrived. Just at the appropriate moment, when the moon was full, the Bodhisattva descended from the Tushita realm and, retaining full memory and knowledge, entered the womb of his mother, who had devoted herself to spiritual practices. Through her right side, he entered in the form of a small white elephant with six tusks. Hopefully they weren't too sharp. His head the color of white, his tusks of gold, his limbs and organs all without imperfection. After entering the womb, he remained on her right side, never moving to the left. Mayadevi, sleeping softly on the couch, saw this in a dream. An elephant entered her womb most beautiful of elephants, with graceful gait and a body immutable as diamond. Completely absorbed in contemplation, never had she felt such happiness, never had she known such pleasure, both in body and mind. So in this dream, the elephant entered her womb, small white elephant, and then she woke up and went to tell the king Suddhodana. Who said, wonderful, amazing, and so on, and said, and then they got the local seers to tell what this omen is about, and very auspicious, white elephant's a good sign. On the night the Bodhisattva entered his mother's womb from the great depth of the sea, from the depth of 68 million yojanas, a lotus rose up to the world of Brahma, seen only by the holy Chakravartin, the best of people, and by the great Brahma, commander of millions of beings. This is a part you may have never heard before. I have never heard this before. This great lotus, gathered in the great lotus in the form of a drop of nectar, a drop of amrita, in this giant lotus, was, in the form of this drop, was the essence, the quintessence of the elementary substances of the 3,000 great thousands of worlds. This one drop contained like the essence of all worlds, of all realms, the nature of everything. And this drop that's manifested in the center of this giant lotus. Placing this drop into a shining vase of lapis lazuli, the great Brahma presented it to the Bodhisattva. Out of mercy toward the great Brahma, the Bodhisattva took the vessel and drank from it. Except for a Bodhisattva who's in his last existence and who has accomplished all the stages of a Bodhisattva, there is no being among all the multitudes of beings who can digest such a drop of elixir. Through the maturation of what actions was this drop of elixir, the lot of the Bodhisattva. He talks about all the merit he's accumulated through all these lives to ingest this drop upon entering the womb of Maya Devi. This drop that is the essence of all worlds. So, how can we see such a thing? Such a strange occurrence. Was it a mind-only drop that contained the realization that all the myriad hundreds of thousands, millions of worlds in their essence were in this drop and now were in the mind of the Bodhisattva? These worlds that aren't really out there. Maybe the special Buddha Alaya drop that enabled the Buddha to completely extend his compassion and embrace to myriads of billions and trillions of worlds, something like that. We don't know, but I thought that was an interesting part of the story. I have not before heard. So, we'll let that Bodhisattva gestate for a while. And another thread here is the Lankavatara Sutra. where the Buddha is talking about word projections associated with each of the eight consciousnesses of mind-only tradition. So even in direct sensory perception, there's word projections, according to this part of the sutra, which we could hear as we make things out of everything. At every experience, we're projecting, and projections have to do with words and concepts. So now Mahamati once more beseeched the Buddha to explain the meaning of this, saying, Bhagavan, please tell us again about the realm in which word projection occurs. Bhagavan, where and why and how and based on what do beings give rise to projection of words? I think words here means, you know, out loud verbalized words, but also all these words, silent words, that spin through our minds during sesshin. So just being, you know, outwardly quiet doesn't mean there's no words going on here. So let's explore these words a little bit, since we have to deal with them the rest of the sesshin, internally and externally. The Buddha told Mahamati, sounds are produced by the conjunction of the head, chest, throat, nose, lips, tongue, and teeth. So he starts off just very practical. Sounds are produced with the tongue touching the palate and the teeth in a certain way. And I think, you know, then he goes into more how the mind does this, but I appreciate how it's like, seeing that actually words, when we're speaking now, and we're having all these images and projections conjured up by words, it's coming from just like the movements of like a tongue in the mouth and stuff. We forget that, right? Especially like if somebody insults us and says, you idiot. You know, it's just actually like a tongue against the teeth happening, but we say, how could they... I'm an idiot. we don't, maybe if we could see it, and, you know, as they're saying, you idiot, we can watch their tongue against their teeth. Wow. What was that sound? Then there would be a different experience. I don't know, but the Buddha says, just talks about the physical production of sound. Then Mahamati asks the Buddha, Bhagavan, are words and projections separate or not separate? Projections, again, here is like parikalpita, imagination. Imagination, projection, imputation are closely linked with words and language, right? So what do you think? The Buddha will say, are words and these projections or imaginations separate or not separate? Any guesses? Not separate? You have one not separate.
Maybe
both.
Neither.
Patrick wins. Words and projections are neither separate nor not separate. And how so? Because one is the cause of the other. Mahamati, if words and projections were separate, projections could not be their cause. So you might think it could be the other way around too, but are words the cause of projections, or are projections the cause of words? But here, the imagination comes first in the story. Projections are the cause of words. And this is a little nice little Madhyamaka type explanation here about neither separate nor not separate, and about dependent co-arising. Nagarjuna will often bring up this kind of thing to show how things are neither truly separate, nor are they the same, but they are interdependent. Right? So this is one of these cases. If words and projections were separate, like I think this means completely separate, like unrelated. If words and projections, you have a word over here and an imagination over here. If they were truly separate like that, then the projections could not be the cause of the words, right? So therefore, they can't be totally separate. But if they were not separate, if they were not separate, words could not express their meaning. You know, if they were exactly the same, then words would be the projection instead of expressing the meaning of the projection. So they're not exactly the same, and they're not exactly different, but they dependently co-arise. I think this is an important teaching about how imagination is completely tied into language. It's not exactly the same. We don't say projections are just words. And, you know, there are, like there's a Western school of philosophy called nominalism, right? Which I think means that there's nothing is real, everything is just words or names, nominalism, which is a little bit different than saying, actually, things are just projections, but the projections are closely connected with words and language. But it's too simple to say things are just words. It's kind of close, you know? Like when we say, this is a book, from a kind of mind-only point of view, we say, that's just a word. It's not really a book. Book is a word, and we think that it is that word, but the only way we can do that is with the projection connected with the word. We need both, and they dependently arise, neither the same or different. Mahamati again asked the Buddha, Bhagavan, are words ultimate truth, or is what they express ultimate truth? Any guesses? The Buddha will say. Actually, in this case, the Buddha replied, Mahamati, words are not ultimate truth. They're just not. And nor is what they express ultimate truth. Even what they express, not ultimate truth. So, should we toss out the sutra now, since there's no ultimate truth in here? Buddha replied, Mahamati, words are not ultimate truth, nor is what they express ultimate truth. And how so? Ultimate truth is what Buddhas delight in, and what words lead to is ultimate truth. Words don't express ultimate truth, but they lead to ultimate truth. What words lead to is ultimate truth, but words are not ultimate truth. Ultimate truth is what's attained by the personal realization of Buddha knowledge. It's not a realm known by means of the projection of words. Therefore, the projection of words does not express ultimate truth. Words arise and cease and shift with their occurrence depending on changing causes and conditions. Mahamati, what depends on changing causes and conditions for its occurrence does not express ultimate truth. The ultimate truth is unconditioned. It doesn't come and go. It doesn't arise and cease. Mahamati, because of the non-existence of their own characteristics or those of something else, words do not express ultimate truth. Moreover, Mahamati, because any characteristic of an external existence does not exist except as a perception of one's own mind, the projection of words does not express ultimate truth. Hence, Mahamati, you should avoid the projection of words. Maybe we could say, avoid believing that the projection of words is ultimate truth. So we have the essence of mind only keeps being repeated again by the Buddha in this case. Any characteristic of an external existence does not exist except as a perception of one's own mind. And that happens with words and projections working together. So also yesterday we were looking at the section in this mind-only textbook called Reflections on Reality, and a chapter called Dread of Reality. It's a scary chapter. Dread of Reality. And in mind-only discussion, we could call it, this is the dread or fear or dread of there being no external world, which I think has been surfaced in our class discussions. Maybe it sounds more like just resistance in general. And maybe it's not to the point of fear, disbelief, but could there be actually fear behind this? May be interesting to explore. And then there was this section about emptiness is being used as a term here, but we could also, let's say, emptiness of the external world. The external world is empty of own being. It's merely projections of mind. So there are reasons for not being frightened about emptiness. This is at the end of this section where there's this ancient Tibetan teacher saying that when actually approaching realization of emptiness or no external world, fear tends to arise. But some people are not afraid of emptiness or afraid of no external world. There's two kinds. And on the one hand, the ignorant who do not know either the term nor the meaning of emptiness or no external world are not frightened because they don't know of any of its disadvantages or advantages. So most people actually in this world are not a slight bit afraid of emptiness. They never even heard about it or about no external world. So most people are in that category. They're not afraid. For example, those who do not know about how one can fall from a horse are brave to mount a wild horse. No problem. We can live in this world and not fall. On the other hand, those who perceive emptiness directly do not fear it either, because they lack the cause of fear, that is, the conception of truly existent external world, which is abandoned through seeing the truth, like a being who has learned the ways of controlling a wild horse. So one type of non-afraid person just hops on a wild horse with no fear of what wild horses can do. Maybe that's really more like, like we were talking about yesterday, like the Heart Sutra, like, yeah, I can, we can chant no eyes, no ears, no nose, and that doesn't seem like such a wild horse. We can ride the Heart Sutra, but we don't realize the extent of how wild it is. There's a new translation that just came out, a commentary of the Heart Sutra by a great teacher and friend of mine named Carl Brunholzl. And the title of his commentary is The Heart Attack Sutra. The Heart Attack Sutra. And I think where he's going with that is that, like, if you really open to the message of the Heart Sutra, you might have a heart attack. So then who does fear emptiness? Does anyone either remember from yesterday who might fear emptiness, or anyone who wasn't here might want to guess? It's not the type that just like, yeah, no problem, that horse doesn't look so wild, and it's not the type that's actually tamed the wild horse. Yeah, that's right. It's suitable for fear to be generated in those who have understood emptiness a little bit and are investigating whether such and such a phenomena exists or not. For suddenly the phenomena appears to their minds to be totally non-existent. An example is a person who has understood a little but not completely how to mount a wild horse. So that actually, they're not like the kind of ignorant person who just jumps on, and not like the person who's tamed it, but they see how wild the horse is, and like, I don't know if I'm going on that, for a ride on that horse. Understanding a little bit in this case is that they think that there's things are totally non-existent and there's nothing at all. It's like fear of obliteration and nothingness, which is not the case, because the appearing world that we live in is not refuted by the view of emptiness or of no external world. Just externality is refuted in mind only. Yes.
Well, the other thing that you referred to yesterday that really took hold of me was nothing to hold on to. That alone creates fear.
Yeah. This came from Huang Bo, who was also all these Zen sayings on mind only. He said, you know, Huang Bo is an early Chinese Zen ancestor, and says that talking about this one empty mind that's all Buddhas and all sentient beings, and it's neither subjective nor objective, it has no location, it's formless and cannot come or go. Those who hasten towards it dare not enter, fearing to hurtle down through the void with nothing to hold on to or to stay their fall. Nothing will catch them. So they look to the brink and retreat. And then he says, this refers to all those who seek such a goal through conceptual thinking. So likewise, I think these would be the people in this version who understand emptiness a little through conceptual thinking, but in, like, they've clarified it conceptually enough that it's starting to become frightening. One explanation for this fear is that beings are so identified with their own afflictive emotions that when their own basis of emptiness starts to manifest, the fight of annihilation is generated. Because actually, if I don't have any afflictive emotions, then I might not exist, because we're so identified with, and we could say subtle ones too, afflictive emotions of just like, you know, annoyance or restlessness or this kind of thing. In Sesshin, we might be afraid to let go of those because it feels like our very identity. The fifth Dalai Lama says about the experience of realizing emptiness or no external world, it's like the moon, the conceptual understanding is like the moon on the second day of the month, just like a sliver of moon in the beginning of the lunar month after the new moon. It's a slight finding of the view. At that time, if you have no predispositions for emptiness from a former life, but we could also say even from this life, dispositions for emptiness, it seems like the thing, like a thing which was in the hand has suddenly been lost. If you have predispositions for realizing emptiness, it seems that a lost jewel, which had been in the hand previously, has suddenly been found. What is experienced with a sense of loss at an early stage is later re-experienced with a sense of finding a treasure that had been lost. Yeah, I think it's like moon is often used as like enlightenment image in Zen and all Buddhism, right? So like the full moon is like complete Buddha mind, radiant, unhindered moonlight. And the new moon would be like totally ignorance. So this little sliver of light on the moon is like a conceptual realization of emptiness. That's how I would understand it. Conceptually understanding is a little bit of light coming in, but it's very different from a direct non-conceptual realization. But in that conceptual realization, if we have some resonance, some karmic affinity with emptiness, then it feels like, wow, this is it. Like, Chandrakirti says, like, you just hear these conceptual things and the hair on the back of your neck starts to bristle with joy. And who knows, without the disposition, hear about it, and the fear arises of, you know, if, and again, I think for fear to arise, we have to start to really understand it enough so that it's like, really? There might not be an external world? I mean, everything that I've ever experienced is actually mind. No, it's nothing about that now. Let's do something else. So I just wanted to, so that I don't have to bring this book back, finish this section. That about fear, you know, it was all about, we heard this whole Christian writer, Rudolf Otto, talking about religious experience yesterday. And he's mentioning this kind of like overwhelming fear and dread sometimes in it, from the Christian tradition, you know, direct experience of God or something like this. And I just want to mention this other side, which is brought up here, that instead of it being an overwhelming, horrific, awful experience, which are these words Otto was using, frequent descriptions in this Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, which is the Dzogchen tradition, and East Asian Buddhism, Zen, has a kind of different take here, and he wants to honor this. He says, in those traditions, descriptions of identifying one's own true nature, one's original face, suggest that the sense of at-homeness, of, quote, being set on mama's lap, unquote, reveals religion not as something separate, but as eventually most familiar. So, you know, these such experiences could happen to people in different ways, as this like overwhelming, mind-shattering disorientation of like, this is not what I thought was the case. Or it could be this very ordinary, like, at-homeness, like resting at on mama's lap, very familiar. And that this is actually often the way that the Zen tradition. Zen tradition has both sides, I think, but I think often has this side, Dzogchen tradition too. and especially Soto Zen, Dogen. Maybe that's a little difference. Maybe Rinzai Zen emphasizes more the mind-shattering, explosive, self-destroying experience, and Soto Zen is like resting in Mama's lap. We realize that we've always been resting there from the beginning, very peacefully, gently, nothing extraordinary. Like that Zen story. What is most extraordinary? Just sitting alone on the local mountain peak here. The sense of the joy and sense of at-homeness that a child feels when in a happy mood, he or she is set on Mama's lap, is an analog to a highly developed yogi's sense of joyful naturalness when they identify and experience their own basic nature. This fundamental, innate, clear, light mind, when experienced by one who's overcome the initial distorted fear and sense of annihilation, is most familiar, most comforting, most common, most ordinary. One might even think that such an experience is not religious because of not having the quality of separateness and awe that Rudolf Otto talks about. But as we have seen, it only seems foreign because of the afflicted state of the practitioner. The experience of this fundamental innate mind as standard everyday stuff of basic mind indicates that this most profound of religious experiences in Indian and we could say Zen Buddhism is not a realm of the sacred that is radically other. Rather, it is one's own nature that is immanent in all consciousness, but is transcendent until its manifestation. When manifested, it loses the distance of transcendence, much as is done in the Vedanta saying, "You are that." But when a consciousness is not yet ready for them, these experiences could be indeed dreadful, fraught with implications, undermining and threatening distorted postures of personality. Any questions or comments? Yes. Yes, that reminds me, we chanted this morning, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, do not be suspicious of the true dragon, which is two animal stories, one about, you know, the blind men feeling the parts of the elephant, right? You maybe heard this one, where, you know, oh, they feel the trunk, oh, an elephant's like a fire hose, they feel the leg, oh, an elephant's like a tree trunk, and they all, in their blindness, think that the part of the elephant is really the elephant. They can't see the whole picture. So Dogen says in the Fukan Zazengi, long accustomed to thinking that the elephant of Buddha is like this or like that, according to our tiny little version of it, do not be suspicious of the true dragon, which is that story of, in a Chinese story of the person who collected toy dragons. Do you know the story? That they, you know, collected, had a dragon collection on a shelf in his room, all different kinds of wooden and metal and jewel dragons, totally obsessed with dragons. And then one day, a real dragon said, "This guy's totally into dragons, but he's maybe never seen a real dragon, so I should visit him. He would feel very at home, maybe like resting in his mother's lap, to see the source of his collection." So the real dragon flew through his window, and the guy had a heart attack. So sometimes it's like that, yeah. Sometimes, or, you know, but maybe later, maybe after the dragon flew in his window, a few times, he no longer had a heart attack each time. And, okay, here comes the real dragon again, I'm ready now. And eventually he started having tea with the real dragon. And then he said to the real dragon, "Can I actually, like, curl up in your lap and take a little nap?" And the dragon said, "Sure, just rest right here. At ease, very comfortable. Nothing to be afraid of, even though I breathe fire. Just to keep you warm." So, tangents upon tangents, words upon projections, layers and layers of external worlds upon external worlds appearing to this mind. And all this talk about conceptual thinking, which we do a lot, and the sutras do a lot, and I kind of have the feeling that, you know, we're on the fourth day of Sesshin, and I know some people are just arriving, but that you're welcome to just forget all of this stuff now and just let go of all these conceptual ideas about external worlds and non-external worlds, and whatever. Experience this and all its blazing glory of what it is-ness, all its highs and lows and pains and pleasures and such a precious treasure for such mama lap resting. Or mind shattering, whatever you get, whatever comes, we're certainly not in control. May any positive energy arising from this discussion be offered to all beings throughout myriad world systems. May they realize inconceivable freedom and joy in the vast ocean of eternal brightness. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow states are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.